Gee, I tell you what, Dr. Walker, the week comes around so quickly sometimes, doesn't it?
It certainly does, certainly does. But lovely to talk to you, mate.
Likewise, mate. It's a Saturday morning in our regular segment with Dr. Ross Walker. We've got quite a few listener questions today, so let's kick off with Marianne. Ross?
Yep.
Marianne says, you spoke last weekend about mosquito bites. Marianne says, when I get bitten by a mosquito now, I come up in big red welts. This has only started to happen in the last couple of years. It never happened to me before. She said, why is this now happening? And what treatment do you recommend to give me some relief from the incredible itchiness that comes with these unsightly red sores?
Yeah, unfortunately, with something like this, it's almost like a form of what we call urticaria, which is a type 1 allergy. So 25% of the population experience type 1 allergies, and they basically encompass things like hay fever, which is about 25% of people, asthma, about 10% of people, urticaria, probably getting close to 10%, which is, urticaria is a bit like eczema. So the skin comes up in welts, and it could be a mosquito bite, it could be an allergy to something else. But when you get an excessive reaction to something like a mosquito bite, it's not just your reaction. There's got to be another layer of immunity there, which is these type 1 allergies. Now, type 1 allergies are mediated through a particular cell in the body called a mast cell, and mast cells are the allergic cells. So they're the things that release all the histamine. So what Marianne's getting is an excessive histamine reaction. And obviously, as we're going into summer and the weather gets hotter, there are more mosquitoes, especially if you're living around water. The only thing you can do is probably take a prophylactic antihistamine over that period of time, something like a non-sedating one, Claritin, Telfast, or if you have a bit of issue sleeping, maybe a Zyrtec at night might help you sleep and also give you some protection against this. But apart from putting some cortisone cream on them once they happen, there's not much else you can do. For people who have full-blown eczema, however, so people are getting a lot of problems with eczema or urticaria, there's now these monoclonal antibodies, which are an injection every week, that can markedly reduce the eczema that people experience. But that's something you've got to have organised through a dermatologist.
Ross, why is Marianne only experiencing this now? She said it as part of a question, it didn't used to happen to her.
That's a great question. Marianne didn't say what age she was, but I'm presuming she's possibly going through menopause now. Because as we all get older, whether it's menopause for women, andropause for men, our immune system changes. Sometimes you get more sensitive, sometimes you get less sensitive. And this is the whole point. We're all different. We all have a different set of genes that responds to things. And when the body changes with things like the hormonal changes of getting into your 50s, that's when all these things can come out or even stop.
Diane said, could you ask Dr. Walker, what are the most common early warning signs of diabetes that you should watch out for?
That's a really good question. And can I say, there are two basic types of diabetes, although there are many other types within those two types. One is the type 1 diabetes, which occurs typically in younger people, the average age between 2 to 12 when people get it, but still 25% of people get type 1 diabetes get it after the age of 20. So it's still relatively common in that age group, whereas type 2 diabetes is related very much to insulin resistance, which is a gene you're born with. 30% of Caucasians are born with the gene, 50% of Asians, and close to 100% of people with darker or olive skin have the gene for insulin resistance. And when you expose these people to Western crap, so excessive processed foods, excessive calories, excessive sitting on your backside all day doing nothing, out comes the manifestations of the insulin resistance gene, which is why, for example, you've never seen a skinny Tongan, because they're the world champions of insulin resistance and obesity. And so when they get exposed to Western rubbish, they bulk up. So what happens is people then develop a tendency to diabetes, and I'll get onto the symptoms in a second, tendency to blood pressure issues. When you look at their cholesterol, up goes the triglyceride, down goes the HDL. And here's the big thing, it's easy to put on fat around the belly and also fat around your neck. So the fat around the belly, which of course we call abdominal obesity, is also an indication of the fat that you have in your organs. You can have fat in the heart, fat in the liver, fat in the kidneys, in the lungs, in the brain even. And so they're all the manifestations of insulin resistance, of which type 2 diabetes is one of those manifestations. But the symptoms of diabetes per se, whether it's type 1 or type 2, the typical ones, the major one is fatigue. People just get washed out. But excessive thirst, excessive passing of urine, so what we call polyuria, polydipsia. Polydipsia is excessive thirst. Polyuria is excessive passing of urine. That's another major feature of diabetes. Recurrent infections, wounds and sores that don't heal that well, another feature of diabetes. So they're the basic things. So if you're getting any of those things, get off to your doctor. And look, doctors will, and Australian GPs do this, and I have no idea why they do it. They'll say, oh, you should have a glucose tolerance test. Waste of time. It's 2 hours of your life you'll never get back. What you do is you have an overnight fasting blood sugar level and fasting hemoglobin A1C, which gives you an indication of the average 3 month control. If your overnight sugar is above 7.5 millimoles per litre, or your HbA1c is above 6.5%, then that is the diagnosis of diabetes. If your sugar level is 6 to 7.5 millimoles per litre, that's pre-diabetes, with an HbA1c of 5.5 to 6.5, also pre-diabetes. The best thing you can do for type 1 diabetes is see an endocrinologist, a diabetes expert, get onto insulin immediately. And let me say, for all of those people who are either dealing with type 1 diabetes or have relatives with type 1 diabetes, over the next few years, we're going to see a move to non-injectable management of type 1 diabetes. So, for example, there's a couple of labs in North Carolina and in South Korea who've developed a patch that you put on your arm that measures your blood sugar level in real time and, based on those levels, delivers insulin across the skin, so transcutaneously, and speaks to your mobile phone. So these are the sort of things that are happening. Also, I spoke on my show about a year ago about the University of Sydney, the University of Norway, have released are investigating this oral insulin that you take with your meals that works better than the injectable insulin. So there's some really, really exciting things happening in the type 1 diabetes space. For type 2 diabetes, and this sounds like a broken record that I go on with all the time, but the best thing anyone can do for their health, because the real pandemic of the 21st century is not COVID, but diabetes, the combination of diabetes and obesity, is to lose the fat off the belly. And that's a combination of reducing your calories. So losing weight off the belly is 80% food, cut back calories, cut back refined carbs, and cut back grog, and 20% is doing exercise.
Duncan's next. Now, look, I've got to say, I read Duncan's question when it came through on the email, and it could have been Brent asking this question. So I thought to myself, great, good on you, Duncan. Duncan's question is this.
You should have a beer with Duncan.
Yeah, that's very good and very quick. Very quick. Duncan says, I had an operation for my sciatica that was causing intense nerve pain down my left leg. I still have pain and numbness nearly 2 years after the operation. I've gone back to the surgeon and he just tells me that's what happens with this procedure. Could you suggest any treatment options available for those suffering from this chronic sciatica pain?
Look, it really depends on what operation he had. The typical operation these days for a sciatica is a microdiscectomy, which is a localized procedure. I'm sure, is that the one you had, mate?
It is, mate, yes.
Yeah. Yeah, and the microdiscectomy is highly effective for most people. But here's the problem. And it's a bit like having your knee replaced. 10% don't work. 10% it's worse after you've had it done. And the same thing with the microdiscectomy. It might take away the acute, excruciating, severe pain, but it doesn't cure the problem. It's a bit like when people have bypass surgery. They think they're cured. No, they're not. They've just had the blockages bypassed. You still have to keep the muck out of the artery. So when somebody has ongoing symptoms, I think there's a few things that can be done, and it depends on really how bad all of this is. So, for example, there is a supplement called alpha-lipoic acid, and the dose is 400 milligrams twice a day. That certainly helps to rebuild the nerves to some extent. I'm not suggesting it's magic. And also the ubiquinol that I talk about all the time, which is the active version of coenzyme Q10, 150 milligrams a day, may give you a little bit of relief. There's an interesting thing with the gut bacteria. So if you have healthy gut bacteria, you make these postbiotics, which are called short-chain fatty acids. One of them is a thing called pyruvate. So if you've got really healthy gut bacteria, you're making more pyruvate, and that's been shown to help regrow nerves. And the other thing I suggest in this situation, if you can find a GP who's doing this, who's not being investigated by the Health Complaints Commission, because the Health Complaints Commission seem to be down on GPs prescribing medical cannabis, is medical cannabis taken at night may also give you some relief for this as well.
On my side of this question, I have never ever had leg cramps before. All of a sudden, I will just be sitting in my lounge chair and only ever in my left leg, which is where I had the left side on the back operation, the sciatic on the left side. I'll be sitting in my chair and all of a sudden, bang, this leg cramp comes onto me and I just have to straighten my leg and try and get through it. What causes those cramps when I've never had them before?
I think it's the fact that you've had the nerve shaved off the disc, but there's still some residual issues with the nerve there. But that's where the ubiquinol and the magnesium orotate / aspartate also works well to reduce the cramps. And also, if anyone's getting ongoing cramps in this situation, I like to know what your electrolytes are doing, so what your kidneys are doing, the calciums, the magnesiums, all of those things, and also your iron levels as well and your thyroid status. So I think if someone's getting cramps they've not had before, yes, it's almost certainly related to the procedure, but you want to make sure there's nothing else going on in the blood that might be making things worse.
Let's do some topics, and then if we still have some time up our sleeve, we'll come back because I've got more questions here. Otherwise, I can transfer the questions to next week, okay?
Yep, sure.
Is it metformin has been found to reduce organ aging in male kidneys? A team of biologists have found that giving male monkeys the type 2 diabetes drug metformin can reduce aging in multiple organs, including the brain.
Yeah, and look, there's two components to this discussion. Firstly, let me make the point that metformin is the workhorse drug for type 2 diabetes. It's been around for years, but the interest in metformin is increasing and increasing because of a study that was done a few years back where they gave metformin to a bunch of type 2 diabetics and they compared them to age-matched control people who weren't diabetic, and they found that the people given the metformin had a significant reduction in heart disease and cancer compared with the non-diabetics who weren't taking metformin. So I thought, gee, this is good. So they're doing now around the world a trial called the TAME study, which is to see if people over the age of 70 given metformin versus placebo have a marked reduction in a lot of aging parameters. So that's to be decided. But again, I think metformin is a blockbuster drug that every type 2 diabetic who doesn't have kidney disease should be taking. And these two studies that have just come out recently, the first one was done on mice and in human laboratory cells, it hasn't been done in humans particularly, to actually look at the genetic mechanisms behind the generations of cancer. And they found that metformin blocks a gene that has a major role in cell growth. And so they found when they gave it to mice or to cell cultures, and they also sequenced DNA, that metformin blocked this particular gene called MIK3CA, and it found that it reduced the progression to cancers in the mice and in the cell cultures and reduced expression of this gene that made the increased growth in all these cells. But they found in the mice who were put onto a high-fat diet or were obese that markedly increased their risk for esophageal cancer. So that's one of the mechanisms by how metformin may block cancers. It also blocks a thing called insulin-like growth factor, which promotes tumours as well. But here's the second study that was done on about 12 monkeys, and it found that over a 40-month period, when they gave them metformin over this period of time, that it markedly slowed down the markers of ageing in all their organs, including, as you say, the brain, where they had the best benefit, the kidneys, the lungs, and the skin. So there's a lot of work accumulating to show that metformin not only is good for diabetes, but may have all of these extra benefits. And many people are now taking metformin as an anti-aging drug, but there's always a but. About 10% of people who take metformin, it really knocks their gut around, giving them either diarrhea, constipation, abdominal cramping or whatever. So none of these drugs are harmless. And I say all the time, I line up 100 people, give them any drug, 90 think I'm a genius and 10 want to throw it at me.
Do you need a prescription to buy metformin?
Oh, absolutely, yeah. And a lot of GPs, probably rightly so, will not prescribe it to people just as an anti-aging drug because the evidence is not out yet. but certainly all type 2 diabetics should be on metformin.
Experimental RNA vaccines, cancer vaccines, show potential for advanced stage cancer patients with lung cancer, melanoma and other solid tumours.
Yeah, and you see, now we're going to get all the anti-vaxxers coming out of the woodworks and say, oh, you can't use these RNA vaccines. But what they're missing at the point in, the RNA vaccines used for COVID, basically it's an RNA copy of the spike protein of COVID, which was very pro-inflammatory. So the fact that some people, not everyone who was given the RNA vaccines, had a bad reaction to the vaccine, in my view, is not because it was the RNA technology that was bad, it was because of the spike protein of COVID that was very pro-inflammatory. So that's the key here. In these experimental cancer RNA vaccines, what they're doing is making an RNA copy of specific antigens that have come from someone's own tumour. So they take people who have end-stage cancers where there's no other hope for them. They get their tumours. They make a personalised vaccine against that person's particular cancer, which then enhances the immune response against the cancer. And in the small group of people that they studied, half of them had no further tumour growth and no new tumours after they'd followed them for a number of months after they were given the vaccine. So with these new immunotherapies and also these new RNA cancer vaccines, we're getting close to being able to give people very, very targeted therapies for their own cancers.
How close?
Oh, look, I think the next few years. I think we're talking 10 years away. These human trials are being done now with very, very promising results.
Do you think in 20 years' time we will have a cure for cancer?
I think we already have some cures for cancer that are being used, and they're being used highly effectively, because you see, cancer isn't one disease. It's an umbrella of diseases. For example, breast cancer is probably 200 different genetic diseases, but they're basically put into three basic categories where they talk about the hormone-sensitive cancers, the HER2-positive cancers, and the triple-negative breast cancers. But it's 200 different genes cause the one cancer. So someone's cancer is their own cancer with their own particular DNA tumour markers. And this is why they're now taking people's own cancer and creating a personalised vaccine against their particular cancer. But with this stuff, there's stuff called CAR-T therapy. They're now using CAR-T therapy. Some trials are being done in Australia, in the US, to use this CAR-T therapy for glioblastoma. And up to now, there's been almost no treatments for glioblastoma. So there's inroads being made in all aspects of cancer management. Very, very exciting stuff.
Lastly today, a new study shows the MIND diet may lower the risk of memory problems later in life. My first question to you is, it's another diet. What is the MIND diet?
Yeah, well, we see, this is the point. When you look at the diet that really has really an evidence base, there's only really one diet that has a really strong evidence base for hard data, like reduction in death, reduction in heart disease, cancer, Alzheimer's, etc., is the Mediterranean diet. Now, the MIND diet, the MIND diet, was a diet that was designed specifically for people who have cognitive impairment who are on their way to dementia. But the MIND diet really is just a combination of the Mediterranean diet and a thing called the DASH diet, which is a diet for high blood pressure, and they're all variations on the same theme. This is going to shock you, Brent, but we're suggesting people should have buckets of fruits and vegetables, leafy greens, grains, extra virgin olive oil, little bits of poultry, fair bit of fish, beans and nuts. And especially with the MIND diet, they're focusing on berries, because berries can concentrate into the brain. So all sorts of berries, blueberries, strawberries, raspberries, and fish with the omega-3 in the fish, that also gets into the brain as well. So this was a study of just over 14,140 patients, average age 64, and they followed them up for 10 years, and they found that those people who were eating more towards the MIND diet, as I said, just the combination of the Mediterranean DASH diet, had a significant reduction in the progression to cognitive impairment. So basically, I think that the important message here is that what you do now in your middle age can really reap benefits as you get older. So the key is not to wait till you disease and then do something about it. The key is to think about the walk of five keys of being healthy right now. No addictions, good quality sleep, good quality eating and less of it, 3 to 5 hours every week of exercise and happiness. And all of those things will significantly reduce your risk for all major killers as you get older.
I think we'll leave it on that note. It's always a good note to leave our discussion. So thank you again for your time. Thanks for answering our listener questions. We've got a couple left over. We ran out of time today. We'll ask them next week when we catch up with Dr. Ross Walker. Enjoy the rest of your weekend, Ross.
Good on you, mate. Lovely to talk to you.